This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
Albert Einstein once said, quote, "To raise new questions, new possibilities, to regard old problems from a new angle, requires creative imagination and marks real advance in science," end of quote. The transformative impact of technological and scientific advances on the biopharmaceutical industry show that Einstein's view resonates today. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the DIA Global Forum. Today, I'm speaking with Craig Lipset, who is head of clinical innovation, global product development at Pfizer. Craig's team is responsible for impacting clinical research through digital tools, improving patient engagement, and novel collaborations. Craig is especially well-suited to chair the Diamond Session titled Radical Technologies, Changing the Future of Biopharmaceuticals at DIA's 2017 Global Annual Meeting this coming June. Today, Craig is joining us to discuss artificial intelligence, advanced analytics, and other radical technologies that will improve tomorrow's biopharmaceutical development process today. Thanks for joining us, Craig, and welcome.
Thank you, Alberto, for both having me on the podcast today and for your leadership in the industry.
Say, radical technologies in biomedical research, and many people think of gene splicing or the microbiome as radical technologies involving the discovery of new treatments. So, Craig, are there any other aspects of biomedical research and development that are being affected by radical changes in technology today?
Well, it's a great question because I agree with you that when we think about some of these radical technologies, we may often focus on the research half of R&D, but there are some tremendous opportunities with radical technologies that are facing biomedical development, our D, that so many of us within the DIA family operate within. I think there are some very exciting opportunities we'll be able to explore in the Diamond Session during the annual meeting that will help to shine some light on some technology platforms that some folks in the audience may have heard of or wondered what they might be, and maybe a few new areas that people will come away hearing about for the first time.
Give us a couple of examples, if you would.
Well, one area that we're very curious to further develop and see what kind of true impact it will make is blockchain. Blockchain is a field that many may associate with Bitcoin, a rather peculiar finance marketplace alternative. But the opportunities for blockchain in other industries outside of finance and in healthcare in particular are very interesting. As we start to think about ownership of data and permissions and controls and the ability to access and share health data from the control of the patient to be shared with not only other providers, but also with the research community, blockchain is looking increasingly like a very interesting platform to enable that type of ecosystem.
How does it work in practice?
Well, this is some of what we still have to unpack for this kind of a use case. In practice, blockchain decentralizes the ledger. So in today's world, there is a central database. Somebody owns and controls that data. Somebody owns and controls the systems where the permissions are being managed. Blockchain disintermediates all of that and distributes what's called a ledger, which is meant to be a chain of connected data points through which we can manage permissions. If any one of the links in that chain are altered by a nefarious individual in the cyber world, the entire chain is then corrupted and it's known, it's exposed. And so the idea here is this, that patients, consumers, can have better control over their information, over their health data, without necessarily having to have everything handed over and stored with just one person or entity or business partner. It creates a much more distributed environment while maintaining security and keeping things very much centered around the consumer, or in our world, patient-centered.
How might this be applied in the clinical trial setting specifically then?
So one of the use cases that we're very interested in is what happens when patients, consumers, people are able to access their trusted health data electronically from their care providers and what they're willing to do with that data and the impact that that can bring on medicine development. Here in the United States, meaningful use criteria as part of legislative initiatives over the last 5-8 years, these legislative initiatives ensure that we as consumers have access to our health data. And not just access, we have a legal right as consumers to access our health data in the format in which our providers are keeping it. So if your doctor is using an electronic health record, you as a patient, as a consumer, have a legal right to access that data electronically. And for many patients, that's brought to life through things like patient portals and other types of interfaces that many of us may have started to see coming from our doctors or hospitals. Now, when we survey patients, we see that over 9 out of 10 respond that they are willing to share their health data to support research. Over 9 out of 10. And that's whether it's a survey of the of an enriched online community like patients like me, or a survey of very engaged patients and caregivers like at Boston Children's Hospital, or very mainstream surveys done by entities like the McCoskey Group. 9 out of 10. The big asterisk to that, Alberto, is that patients need to have trust and confidence in that system. But when that trust and confidence is there, they're willing to share that data. Now, even if 9 out of 10 is ambitious, maybe it's too grand, maybe it isn't real, maybe it's half that number, even half that number would be remarkable, transformational, if patients are able to no longer just have to self-report their data or tell their provider or researcher where their biopsy or other data may be, but now through the tap of a button on their phone, be able to simply share that trusted electronic health data with researchers. We think about e-source a lot. A lot of people are very excited about the potential of electronically sourcing our data. Could that mean the future where electronic data capture forms are rendered obsolete? And one of the reasons people may say that's a long time in coming is because of the challenge of health data interoperability, that one EHR can't talk to another. But what happens when all of those EHRs can all talk to the same common denominator? The patient, and that patient is then willing to share that data with researchers. All of a sudden, health data interoperability is mitigated in a very patient-centric way, and where blockchain could be an important enabler of managing those permissions that allow the patient to choose, to have that trust, that big asterisk in that number of 9 out of 10 willing to share.
Does blockchain require EHR systems as they exist today to be more integrated, or is it does not have that requirement actually?
Doesn't necessarily need that requirement, because your EHR itself wouldn't necessarily live in this blockchain. What can live in the blockchain are your permissions and your preferences that you as a consumer can manage. Your health data can still move the way it moves today, albeit moving back through the patient, as I mentioned earlier, is a way to mitigate some of that interoperability that's a challenge today. But in the blockchain, to keep it relatively light and nimble, it would be primarily your permissions.
So what is the horizon for the implementation of blockchain? It sounds like if it isn't dependent on integration of EHRs, it might happen sooner rather than later?
It's a very interesting space, and I have to say it's very exploratory. We've been building some prototype apps along the lines of what I was describing to enable that type of data sharing. Within certain experiments here at Pfizer, there was made public a collaboration between between IBM and the FDA to better explore and experiment with blockchain use cases. It's a very new space, and so many of us need to build more comfort and confidence, very similar to how so much of the industry needed to build confidence in cloud computing. Once upon a time, it was almost considered absurd that a large pharmaceutical company would give up their data farms and allow clinical trial data to exist in cloud-based systems outside of their physical control. I think blockchain will go through a very similar evolution as people learn and understand and experiment. Now, there are some experiments that we as companies can do together with our partners today, not necessarily with health data. Some companies can start to experiment with blockchain around their financial systems and how they manage payments together with some of their vendors. So there are lots of different ways that blockchain could be experimented with and learned within a company to build the right level of confidence for this to really reach that true disruptive, that true radical impact that we're looking for.
Thank you. In addition to blockchain, would you care to mention a second radical technology that's developing today?
I think that artificial intelligence and cognitive computing is another area with such great potential and still only somewhat really understood, and a technology that the impact in drug development today is really only marginal at best. As I think about the study protocol, just as one example, and we start to think about all of the incredible technologies and data that are being used to drive protocol authoring and the steps that follow downstream, so many of them start to feel like they lend themselves to a tremendous future driven by artificial intelligence and cognitive computing. The analogy I would point to would be the autonomous car. Now, Alberto, I know that you, as an Italian, probably think that an autonomous car is just absurd. But for some people out there, an autonomous car, a self-driving car, actually might have a certain amount of appeal. But whether you love it or not, there is a nice analogy here, because you think about how that autonomous car works. It's looking at a lot of different diverse data, and it's taking action based on that data. Now, for a driverless car, for the autopilot type of feature in a Tesla, there's still a steering wheel. There's still the opportunity for a human to intervene, and I know that Google and others might be showing other types of models without a steering wheel, but now let's think about that applied to a clinical trial protocol and think about the diversity of data that we use today to drive the construction of our protocol. Epidemiologic data, historic data, real-world data and other types of epidemiologic data, competitive intelligence, so many different sources of data that today all flow through humans to try to make decisions off of those data and what to include in their protocol. You know, the next step downstream, if you're using common protocol templates like we see from Transcellery today, is that humans then have to decide what data you need to define for your study that you want in your case report forms or in your study database. What's the data that I need to collect for my study? And then we put it on case report forms, and we have humans manually enter that, and then we write different types of reports and other things based on that data. Every one of the steps in that process has some level of initiative today around automation, where we can enable protocols to be constructed using data in more automated ways, where we can then use common protocol templates that can help drive the identification of what data needs to be collected in the study. And if we know what data we need to collect in that future state with eSource, are we then able to acquire the data we need? And I'm sure, as we'll see at this year's DIA meeting through the exhibit hall and elsewhere, there are places where technology is being used to support automated content generation, like patient narratives and maybe even CSRs. And so when you start to string those pieces together, Alberto, is there some machine like that Tesla on autopilot that we can start to envision where cognitive computing and artificial intelligence are putting those pieces together, and our clinician and study team still are sitting at the steering wheel, but they're really hands off unless a course correction is needed.
Hey, Craig, you seem to be foretelling a future in which artificial intelligence, machine learning will drive a lot of judgment on the part of machines, replacing or at least supplementing judgment on the part of humans, and at a much faster speed than humans have been able to do or would be able to do at any time. Is that in line with what you're thinking?
I certainly see a lot of opportunities for automation removing a lot of the low-value work that we may have in our studies, work that may at times decrease quality or otherwise have a negative consequence on the efficiency for our study. And so certainly agree there that with automation and that type of computing, there's some great opportunity for more elements of our study to go driverless. But I'm not saying that it's completely autonomous. I still think that we as humans, we as scientists, we need to enter the destination that we want into that autonomous vehicle. And there may be times when we need to make course corrections, where we need to make an adjustment in the route that's been plotted.
Is this the technology that you think will have the biggest impact on the industry, or can you think of others that will have a reasonably short-term impact on the pharmaceutical industry? In addition to new blockchain and artificial intelligence, machine learning, can you think of others that will impact the industry in a big way?
I certainly see a lot of enthusiasm and uptake around the use of novel technologies for acquiring data for studies today. And because of that spike in uptake that continues to seem to rise, actually, I would say that the opportunity for that to bring much more near-term impact into drug development is very exciting. Things like blockchain and richer use of artificial intelligence, I think we'll have a longer tail to really reach that same level of impact or reach its peak. But some of these new ways of acquiring data, whether using mobile technologies, sensor-based or otherwise, are really finding their way into studies today. These are not necessarily limited to thinking about technologies of the future. I think really the opportunity for us is to continue to think about augmented and enhanced ways that those technologies can acquire more and more meaningful data in our studies.
People these days are talking frequently about big data, which increasingly perhaps becomes too vague a term to be very useful. Are the technologies you're talking about going to take us beyond the vague concept of big data and make our conversations more granular, more specific, including the ability to handle what we now call big data and make it really operational, useful, and usable?
Isn't big data a funny term? I was in a meeting not too long ago, and somebody included on a slide about having colossal data. And it turned into almost this argument of my data is bigger than yours. But to be honest, we actually do see some of that little bit of a grudge match of these relative nature around my data being bigger than yours, that clinical trial data, that's small compared to electronic health records, and electronic health records, that's small compared to the whole domain of real-world data and real-world evidence. In many ways, though, it doesn't matter, right? If your data is big or small, it's what insights you can drive from it and what impact you're able to make. And whether that's through a nominal-sized, modest volume of data, but with really smart analytics and intelligence layered on top of it, or the ability to scrape through and mine and generate learnings that span across big, I would probably caution against, probably as you're hinting, that big data necessarily means better data in all cases.
And do you think this technology will help us parse through this massive data, big, colossal, or cosmic, or whatever one may call it, to start making sense of it and turning it, as someone has suggested, from real-world data to real-world evidence that can actually be useful?
Yeah, it has to, right? So I look at some of the initiatives that we have underway just inside of our house here at Pfizer. One that comes to mind that we've talked about a bit externally, and I think will come up in this Diamond session actually as well, is a collaboration in Parkinson's disease that we've had together with IBM, looking at a very wide range of data from Parkinson's patients and the ability to use that data to better quantify or even predict different events and outcomes, states of being for the Parkinson's patient, places where today we rely almost entirely on self-reported data, but where we've been looking at not even just a few dozen, but in some cases well over 100 different types of sensor data. The only way we can do that is with smart algorithms that sit atop that data that let us help to make sense of that data and tease out which data elements are most meaningful, not just as individual data streams, but as composite measures looking across those different data points to generate clinically meaningful output. So I would agree that, you know, the need for better and smarter analytics is here, and a lot of the tools are here, but it's a marketplace I struggle with. I would say at least 2-3 times a month, I get an inbound message in my inbox, maybe my voicemail, some people still use that, but that message will say that the person is calling from a clinical analytics company. And honestly, Alberto, I scratch my head. I don't know what that means anymore, but maybe if I spend some time on the exhibit hall at the DIA, I'll get a better understanding. But there's just so many things that are falling under that category today that we really need to understand, not just who can, quote, do analytics, but what are the right types of analytics to apply to some of the different data and challenges we're up against?
It turned into a slightly different topic. I note that your team is also responsible for improving patient engagement and for novel collaborations. So I wanted to ask you, can you give us a little more insight into what you're aiming at to improve patient engagement and what are these novel collaborations?
As I think about our priorities for engaging patients in research, we tend to focus in three very related and interconnected areas. The first is around our ability to work with patients to generate insights that we can use as a part of our development planning and other elements I'll speak to in a moment. Now, how do we do that? Well, it does vary a bit with the protocol we may be developing in the patient population, but by and large, these are insights that can be gleaned by actually talking to real live patients, whether convening through different patient advisory panels, whether working together with advocacy or online community or other means. We've actually baked into our protocol development process here at Pfizer that every new protocol is expected to be prepared to answer the question, what feedback did you get from patients about this study, and how did you use that feedback to change the protocol? Those insights are sort of step one. The other two elements for us are around patient experience and their information needs. We're working hard to try to improve the experience of the patients who participate in our studies. Thanks to leaders like Ken Getz, we emotionally think of these patients as heroes, but that's not always the experience that we actually provide those patients when they're looking for trials, when they're participating, or when those trials complete. In order to improve that experience, though, don't talk to me. I'm not a patient with sickle cell, breast cancer, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, or any of the other indications that we may be developing in today. That's where we have to talk to patients and listen and understand what they need and what can make for a great experience. Well, I mentioned insights and I mentioned improving their experience in the trial, but the last area for us has been around meeting the information needs of patients. And we break that out as information that they need before a trial, so helping them to make sure that information about our portfolio is broadly available to them, information that they need during a trial, like we're making available with electronic informed consent and different apps and tools for patients in our studies. But importantly, in an area that's easy to overlook, the information needs of patients after they complete our trial and the commitment that we have to returning patient-friendly results back to those patients, the learnings from the study in ways that they can understand, and some of the experiments we continue to progress around returning individual data back to the patients who participated in the study, where data earns trust. And it's a great way for us to both meet needs of the patient, show respect, but also do something that our industry needs a lot more of, steps to improve trust and reputation.
So is the industry, yours included, engaging in novel collaborations with patients, as you've just described? Is that an example of a new collaboration with the patient as a partner in the product development enterprise, full partner?
I think that's definitely one piece of it. And as I mentioned, in terms of thinking, when we think about technologies in our studies, I'm excited at how that feels more and more like co-developing as we engage patients earlier and earlier in the process of thinking about what are the tools that are most meaningful to them. But the other collaborations in our industry are right in lockstep in these initiatives and areas as well. That theme I mentioned about returning results and information back to patients is work that you see embodied in initiatives like Transcelerate and the Harvard Multi-Regional Clinical Trial Center, where the Harvard MRCT has produced recommendations for the research community and best practices around returning results back to patients. And Transcelerate has produced some best practices about how to produce different types of patient-friendly summaries, as well as where we might need to work together in defining how to redact data to protect patients when data is being shared. So I think a lot of these collaborations, I'd be remiss not to include a city, the Clinical Trials Transformation Initiative, which very early on was including patients as a stakeholder in their organization, where there are initiatives inside of city that have been kicked off by their patient partners and where they've published some very forward-leaning and progressive work around best practices for partnering with patients. I think we're seeing this more and more across the ecosystem, that the spirit of how to best include patients in development and the opportunity to work together in the industry and with other organizations to realize that future.
Well, Craig, we've come to the end of our time together, and I want to thank you for sharing so many visionary insights with us, and really many thanks for your time today.
It's a pleasure, Alberto. I'll look forward to seeing you soon at the annual meeting, and thank you so much for your time today.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.